from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
From Louisville Public Media. Support for this podcast comes from Kindred Healthcare, specializing in rehabilitation and long-term acute care services for 30 years. Questions about care after a hospital stay can be answered by speaking with a registered nurse at 1-866-KINDRED. And from KTC Building, seamlessly blending the classic character of older structures with 21st century amenities and technologies. Residential and commercial remodeling projects of any size. Details at KyleThompsonCompany.com.
I'm Rick Howlett. Today on WFPL's In Conversation, we're going to revisit a few of the topics we've covered since the launch of the show back in January. We'll hear portions of our programs on the surge in youth vaping across Kentucky and the rest of the country, and the health consequences, plus vaccinations and infectious disease outbreaks, and the state of Louisville's many parks. Since today's show was recorded, we won't be taking any calls. In Conversation wouldn't be possible without you. To support the work we do, visit WFPL.org/supportinconversation or look for the link in our show notes. Welcome to WFPL's In Conversation. I'm Rick Howlett. We get program support from Kindred Healthcare. Today we're going to talk about youth vaping, the use of e-cigarettes or other such devices to inhale vapor, often flavored, containing nicotine and, as we'll learn, other substances. Health officials say youth vaping has skyrocketed in the last couple of years, especially among high schoolers, but an alarming number of middle schoolers, sixth graders, have at least tried it. Health officials say vaping brings its own set of health risks. It's addictive, it can cause lung damage and cancer. Sometimes these devices can even explode. They say e-cigarette manufacturers are making the devices attractive to children. Manufacturers say, however, their product is not being directed to children. It's designed to help adult tobacco smokers kick the habit. Well, here to talk about all this and the consequences of vaping and efforts to discourage kids from picking up the habit are Ben Chandler, who's president of the nonprofit Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky, established in 2001 with the goal of making Kentuckians healthier, according to its website. I should disclose that Louisville Public Media has received financial support from the foundation for various endeavors. Also here is Dr. Daniel Conklin. He's a professor of medicine at the Christina Lee Brown Envirome Institute at the University of Louisville, specializing in cardiovascular research and the effect of environmental pollutants, including tobacco-related products on our bodies. Let's start with you, Ben. According to research cited by your foundation, youth vaping in Kentucky roughly doubled, even more than doubled, in some age groups from 2016 to 2018. After apparently falling the previous 2 years. What's causing this?
Well, it's a quite remarkable thing to see the rate double. And really, it's been the popularity of a device called a Juul. It's spelled J-U-U-L. It's manufactured by a company out in California, and they have, last we looked, taken over 78% of the market, of the vaping market, in no time at all, really. In fact, they become so popular that Altria, the parent company of Philip Morris, bought a significant, I think maybe about a 35% stake in the company. So it's big business. It's become big business here in this country. And our concern almost entirely is with the very, very big spike in the rates of youth use. We're really not nearly as concerned about adults using these products because we think there may be, and the jury's still out on this, and maybe Dr. Conklin can talk about it a little bit more, we think there may be some efficacy in its ability to assist adult smokers in quitting. But our concern is that it is very, very attractive to youth smokers and has caused this huge spike. These products are full of nicotine, And I don't think there's any question in the world that nicotine is a very, very bad thing for the developing mind, the developing brain, and it's tremendously addictive. Nicotine is a product that many say is every bit as addictive as opium.
And now the study that we talked about included 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders, but I understand this is also popular among college students.
It is. And again, it's we've seen such a spike in a very, very short space of time. It really is, I would consider it an epidemic here in this country amongst young people. And our worry, of course, is we're addicting an entire new generation to these activities, and they are not safe.
Now, as you mentioned, this is a national thing. Is it more popular among certain age groups, or is there a racial component to it? Does it cut across certain demographics?
Well, for some reason, yes, I think it does cut across demographics generally. But, you know, Kentucky, as in so many things, tends to have a higher level of unhealthy behaviors. Why that is, I'm not entirely sure. But our numbers are higher than the national average with vaping, just as they are with smoking. And, of course, as you know, we're generally unhealthy. We lead the nation in cancer, for starters, but we have a tremendously high rate of cardiovascular disease and just about every other health indicator that you can think of.
And what is the law right now in Kentucky on buying vaping products? Is there an age limit?
Well, there is an age limit, but the age limit is 18. There is no tax on other than your basic sales tax. There's no excise tax on vaping products, which is one thing that we recommend, very highly recommend. But there also moves afoot presently led by Senator McConnell. He made his announcement several weeks ago. That he was going to raise the age or attempt to raise the age from 18 to 21 to purchase these products. Now, the reason for that is that 18-year-olds are a group that, you know, would socialize with 16, 17-year-olds on a regular basis. They don't socialize as much with 21-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And I think most observers, most experts in the field, think that raising the age to 21 would have a positive effect on the use of these products by young people.
Dr. Daniel Conklin from the University of Louisville, let's turn to you. You've been involved in a number of studies on the health effects of vaping, and as we mentioned, some have been led to believe that it's a safer alternative to combustible cigarettes, but you, of course, dispute that.
Well, that's what we're trying to answer. There's a big question about the long-term health effects of e-cigarette use, and it's complicated to look at diseases that take many decades to form. Heart disease in particular, changes in the blood vessel take a long time. So waiting for that answer in the general public is too long to wait. So we try to provide information to the Food and Drug Administration to make decisions based on science. And in some of those studies, we use animal models of human disease, expose them to controlled conditions. This might include cigarette smoke, might include nicotine alone, might include e-cigarette aerosols. And then we look at outcomes that reflect changes that would be found in human blood vessels. And unfortunately, our early work, preliminary work, but also work around the world, suggests that exposure to e-cigarette aerosols are potentially damaging to the cardiovascular system.
Now, manufacturers, and I have a statement from Juul that I'm going to read in a moment. Juul and other manufacturers say their product is designed to help adult smokers kick the habit. Do you see this as a viable thing? As an alternative for adult smokers who want to quit?
Certainly, I want to echo Ben's comments on that. Quitting smoking is a very challenging thing because of the addictive nature of nicotine. On average, it takes at least 6 quit attempts before someone is successful. So it's not an easy thing to do. So we certainly, as part of the collaboration with the American Heart Association, suggest that anyone who's trying to quit could certainly go through standard treatments, nicotine replacement therapy, some pharmacological treatments, but put electronic cigarettes within the toolbox of healthcare providers, and that they should talk to their doctors about that.
This would be a good opportunity to bring in Chris on the phone. Chris from the Highlands, what's on your mind, Chris?
Hi, thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I have a question. You were talking about the numbers for vaping are up for middle school and teenagers, and I was just curious, what about the numbers of the same age group for smoking traditional cigarettes? Are they down? And the reason I ask this is I taught school in Europe for nearly 12 years, and I recently moved back. And during the time that I taught school over there, when I first started teaching, a lot of kids, middle school, teenagers, smoked traditional cigarettes. And by the time I left, almost all of them, like 90%, had given up traditional cigarettes and had switched to vaping, which personally I think is better. But I'm just curious if what the numbers are on kids giving up traditional cigarettes here in America.
Can you answer that?
I'd be happy to at least give a general answer to it. The numbers continue to decline. And that has been going on for quite some time. We've seen a decline in the United States in general, and we've seen a decline in Kentucky in youth smoking traditional cigarettes. Now, Kentucky's youth smoking rate is still considerably higher than the national average. In fact, it's some 65% above the national average. So we've still got a long way to go. There is no evidence, however, that that decline is directly related to vaping, that is the reason for that there's some connection between vaping and the decline. In fact, we're seeing lots of indications that there are quite a substantial number of young people who are beginning the vaping habit who would not have smoked at all. Would not have smoked traditional cigarettes at all. So I think it's a bit of a mistake to make that connection between the decline in the smoking rate of traditional cigarettes and the introduction of vaping products.
We did reach out to Juul to ask if they would want to have somebody on the program. They declined to do that, but sent some fact sheets and various information and a statement saying, we don't want anyone who doesn't smoke or already use nicotine to use Juul products, especially youth. It's bad for public health and it's bad for our business. Our success ultimately depends on getting our product in the hands of adult smokers and out of the hands of youth. When adult smokers try it, it works and the impact is life-changing. And they went on to talk about, we launched our four non-tobacco and non-menthol-based Juul pod flavors, mango, fruit, cream, and cucumber, as tools to help adult smokers switch from cigarettes. We're starting to see the critical impact these products have through our behavioral science program, as we have noted. You've been listening to a portion of our May 24th show on youth vaping, featuring Ben Chandler from the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky and University of Louisville Professor of Medicine, Dr. Daniel Conklin. You can hear all of our programs at WFPL.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Still ahead, we'll listen back to some of our discussion about vaccinations, concerns about vaccines, and the outbreak of certain infectious diseases. We'll be back with more after a break. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL.
We get support for In Conversation from our sponsor, Kindred Healthcare, specializing in rehabilitation and long-term acute care services for 30 years. Questions about care after a hospital stay can be answered by speaking with a registered nurse at 1-866-KINDRED.
Pivotal moment for the West End of Louisville, but is it revitalization or gentrification?
Any improvement they do around here has got to be better.
They're not really asking us, do we want it, do we need it, and can we benefit by it?
The rents are going to rise so fast that they're going to have to leave.
Here Today, a new podcast, will track the changes in West Louisville and how they affect the people who call it home. Follow us at heretodaypodcast.org.
Welcome back to WFPL's In Conversation. I'm Rick Howlett. We're going to listen now to some of our discussion about vaccinations. It came amid outbreaks of measles, chickenpox, and other diseases around the country. Health officials say those have been caused in part by people refusing to have themselves or their children vaccinated because of concerns about vaccine safety or on religious grounds. In northern Kentucky, some Catholic students and their parents are suing a health department after it canceled extracurricular activities and later imposed a temporary ban on school attendance for unvaccinated students as the chickenpox outbreak spread. This is a portion of our vaccination program that aired May 10th. Turns.
Well, first off, there is zero evidence that vaccines are associated with autism or autism spectrum diseases, and that has been a false proclamation that has led to a great deal of harm across the world, frankly, due to what is, frankly, bad science, in my opinion.
And what about folks? What is Kentucky's policy on people who, for another reason, want to get an exemption from being vaccinated or having their children vaccinated?
So in the state of Kentucky, families can opt out of getting vaccinations based on religious exemption grounds that requires them to submit a form that is notarized to the Department for Public Health.
And what is your opinion about people who intentionally expose their children to chickenpox or whatnot in order to have them become immune to it?
Yeah, so chickenpox exposures is actually fairly common. Those who are in their 40s, 50s probably remember chickenpox parties at one time in history as a way to get people exposed to chickenpox at an early age. However, now that the vaccine is available and the vaccine is safe, it is recommended that children be vaccinated for chickenpox, one, to prevent the possible spread of other diseases. Because when you take your child to expose them to someone who might have chickenpox, you're relying on the hope that child actually does have chickenpox. And it could be another disease, and especially amongst a population that isn't getting vaccinated. As far as you know, that disease could possibly be something more serious. So I strongly encourage folks to get the chickenpox vaccine as opposed to exposure when available to them. But I will say that Kentucky is a state that values its personal liberties, and some folks strongly want to opt out of vaccination. I see it as my job as commissioner and my department's job as the Department of Public Health to make sure people are aware of the pros and cons of vaccination and that we are really do what you asked me when we started, and that is, subvert innuendo, bad science, and make sure people really know the facts about the safety and effectiveness of vaccines.
Let's go to the phones here. 502-814-TALK is our number. We want to hear what you think about this. 502-814-8255. Let's go to Bonnie from Louisville, who wants to voice a concern about not lumping everyone together as anti-vaxxers. Hi, Bonnie. What's on your mind?
Hi. I really appreciate the work you guys do, but I think this panel is very unbalanced because they're all pro-vaccination medical professionals, and there's not a balance. There is science that debates the components of vaccines, that debates the little liability that drug companies have when there are vaccine injuries. There's so many issues that get neglected by lumping people into pro-vaccination and anti-vaccination. There's a spectrum. There are people who don't believe in vaccinations. There's some of us who believe in modified schedules. There's some of us who are acutely aware of the influence of pharma on doctors and legislators. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of debate going on about those things that you just can't lump into anti-vaxxers, and progressives are really being the handmaidens of pharma when they don't let people talk about those things. There is science about mercury and formaldehyde and some of the components that are in vaccines that is science that never gets talked about. And to paint people who have concerns about vaccination as crazed and uninformed, I think progressives do a real disservice to the debate and help legislate bodily invasion without conversation and serious dialogue.
Bonnie, thanks so much for your call. I really appreciate your opinion. And she brings up a good point. We were planning this show. We were trying to find one person who could speak for everyone, and that is just not possible. Don, let's get your viewpoint on this. How do you approach people like Bonnie and others who have different concerns about different vaccines and the process as a whole?
Well, I respect what she has to say. Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem is we know that patients, they trust their healthcare provider. I can only imagine being a pediatrician having to vaccinate a family at a time. A mom may bring in 3, 4, 5 children at a time, and you go from one room to the next to the next. There's no time to educate. There are ingredients in vaccines that sound horrible, if you will. For example, Bonnie mentioned formaldehyde. There is a small amount, but it's to kill any other viruses or inactivate any toxins during the manufacturing process. So there is a reason they're there. I believe that we really need to open up this conversation and listen. We have people who are absolutely against vaccines, and we have those who are absolutely pro. And as Bonnie says, there's a group in the middle. And as I was listening to her, she said, you need to take the time to listen and to hear this. And that's, to me, that's the concern. So just an example of a way of looking at a vaccine to me is think about your child, and you want to buy a car for your child. You want the very safest car that you can get for that child. You want all the airbags. You want to know that there's cameras on it. The vaccines are similar to that, if you will. Yes, there's a small chance that that airbag may rupture and cause a chest injury or something such as that, but it's not going to be, and that's blowing it out of proportion, but it's not going to be something that's going to harm. In other words, the risk of the vaccine is so much less than the risk of the illness itself. But she makes an excellent point. If your healthcare provider is not providing you the information, taking the time to give you the correct information, then we're going to go to our favorite website, our social media, our friends, our neighbors, and we're going to start talking. And then we take up on these type of, whatever we're hearing, we hear it and we just tend to go along with it. We have to break the cycle, if you will. And I don't think breaking the cycle in a negative way is going to help us. I think we need to bring some positive things in there and looking at a different approach as to why people choose not to vaccinate.
Dr. Howard, I'd like to get your thoughts on this. Does the state do an adequate job, in your opinion, of informing parents and people about just providing general information about vaccinations and vaccines?
Well, first, let me say that there was a lot of good points made in both those last comments, and you're absolutely right. People need to be heard, and they should be accepted for their viewpoints. And that's the reason earlier when I talked about the phrasing anti-vax, and I don't like that phrasing because it sort of puts and shines people in a negative light, and that's not what we should be doing. What we should be doing is inviting conversation, dialogue. We should be searching together, even if we disagree together. We should be searching the evidence and making sure that we're informing people as best we possibly can. If there's points of contention or points of disagreement, once we've dived into the evidence, then reasonable minds could disagree, and that's just fine. But we should try to make sure that we're working together to create a dialogue that is safe for all viewpoints and that we're able together to reach a meaningful conclusion that is acceptable for all people. Now, in regards to whether the state is doing an adequate job of informing people, I think so. We're doing a ton of work to make sure people are aware of vaccines. But a lot of this falls down to the physician level. Now, as it was pointed out earlier, it's difficult for pediatricians. They have a lot on their plate. They often have full schedules. But they're the ones on the front line with the patients. they're the ones going to get to sit down and look across from that from a mother or father and explain to them the risk of illnesses, the risk of polio, the risk of measles. Even for a family who decides not to vaccinate their child for chickenpox and perhaps wishes to expose them to chickenpox, they still have to sit across from them and explain later in that child's life they're still at a higher risk to get shingles compared to someone who got the vaccine, and shingles can be a very debilitating illness. So a lot of the explanation is going to fall to frontline physicians and providers and our nurse practitioners, PAs are in our communities. And so we as the Department of Public Health want to make sure they have those resources available, and they are available to them.
Let's go back to the phones. 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255 is the number to call if you want to get in on this. Let's go to Michael in Louisville. Hi, Michael. What's on your mind? Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I was wondering if someone on the panel could shine some light on an aspect of the research behind vaccines that is a source of questioning for a lot of people, in my experience. And that is, at least a lot of studies I've seen, they don't use a true placebo. So instead of using something like a saline injection, they'll still use an injection that just doesn't have the virus itself in it, but still has, you know, all of the components that, you know, the aluminum and things that, like the other caller, Bonnie, was saying, are in these things. They're still in the placebo, as they call it. And I think if that were, you know, if they were able to use a true placebo, it might, you know, make people feel a little better about the research.
Thanks for your call, Michael. Dr. Howard, do you have any thoughts on that?
I appreciate that perspective. I would have to look into the exact literature that the gentleman referenced. However, I will say this in general, most of our scientists are trying to create conditions that are as equal as possible so that the outcome of the studies aren't confounded by other possible differences. And so in as lay terms as possible, if you're putting some sort of treatment to someone, you want to make sure that your treatment, your actual treatment arm, is as similar to the sort of control group or what he was referencing as placebo group as close as possible, so there's less likely to be confounding in the outcome. And I think that's what he's getting at. Again, I would have to refer to the specific studies that he was referencing, because there is a vast amount of literature on this issue. Perhaps other folks can comment.
Go ahead, Don.
Michael, there are other ingredients in vaccines. We know that aluminum is in some of the vaccines, and it's a very small amount, and it's there to help stimulate the body's response to the vaccine. We also know that there's some sugars and some gelatin, but that these are ingredients that keep that vaccine very potent, because during the transportation and storage of the vaccine, there's a little bit of an antibiotic of neomycin that's in the measles. I'm speaking specifically of the MMR vaccine now. But that neomycin's there to prevent any contamination of bacteria that may be in the vaccine during the manufacturing process. So there are other ingredients, but they're very small amounts, and they are very safe amounts.
You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPO. We're talking about vaccinations and vaccines and infectious diseases with Dr. Jeffrey Howard, who is the commissioner of the Kentucky Department of Public Health. Don Balcom is here as a family nurse practitioner at the University of Louisville Global Health Center. I want to talk, well, let's go back to the phone. Andrew from Elizabethtown is here. Andrew, what's on your mind? Hello. Hello, Andrew. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes,
can please. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
So one of the things that I've observed is that the people that tend to be opposed to vaccinations are people who don't know what life was like in our country prior to that vaccination being effective. So, for example, I'll use measles or polio. People that are opposed to the measles vaccine, I don't know anyone that was alive in the 40s and 50s who saw thousands of people die from measles or hundreds of thousands of people being hospitalized. As an example, I've got, I know somebody who was born in the 70s. They are opposed to the measles vaccine because in the last 10 years, according to the CDC, 800 people died from the vaccine, there were no measles deaths. However, if you look at the last 10 years before the measles vaccine, 5,000 people died from the measles. 150,000 people were hospitalized because of the measles. We didn't have a vaccine at that time. And there were another several hundred thousand families that were negatively impacted by the measles in a 10-year period before the vaccine was developed. And now in the last 10 years, we've had 108 people die, and all they see is 108 people died from the vaccine. They don't see those hundreds of thousands of people who were negatively impacted by measles before the vaccine. Thank you.
Thank you for, very much for your call. Don, has that been your experience? There is a generational effect here in place here.
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. You know, and the measles, it not only affects our child. We never anticipate in our life that we're going to become HIV positive or we're going to become immune compromised through some kind of a disease or through taking a medicine to help treat a disease like cancer. We have to take chemotherapy or a lot of the new medications to treat people who suffer from lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. Those medicines are excellent, but unfortunately, they make us more susceptible to other disease. So by vaccinating your child, if I were to have a little two-year-old and I am not so sure that vaccinating's safe and I hold off and then 6 years later I'm diagnosed with cancer, well now what if my child gets measles? And then they come in contact with me. Chances are good I'm going to get measles too. So measles just doesn't only affect one person. It affects all of us.
We have time for one more quick question. Mary, I've got just about 30 seconds.
I just want to know, when a baby is going, 6-month-old is going through airports and into states with rampant, why they cannot get vaccinated before 12 months?
Yeah, actually, Mary, they can. The CDC has approved that infants 6 months of age and up to, 6 months and older, if they are traveling, can receive, if they're going into an area of risk, which is mostly everywhere now, that it is safe for them to have the vaccine after the age of 6 months. Now, this doesn't negate the other two vaccines that they will need on the normal schedule for their immunizations for school, but this will protect them.
That was a portion of our May 10th discussion of vaccinations and those who refuse them on religious grounds or concerns about vaccine safety. Our guests included Dr. Jeffrey Howard, Kentucky Public Health Commissioner, and University of Louisville family nurse practitioner Don Balcom. After a break, we'll hear some of our discussion about Louisville's parks. You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL.
Communities across this country are losing their most reliable sources of local news. Well, fortunately, public radio is still going strong, and that's thanks to listeners who donate. I'm David Green. Please support local and national journalism.
Support now at WFPL.org.
Welcome back to WFPL's In Conversation. I'm Rick Howlett. In our third and final segment of the program today, let's listen back to some of our discussion about Louisville's parks with four people who oversee some of those facilities. From Eva Banman to Shawnee, from Cherokee to Waverly, from Jefferson Memorial Forest to the Egg Lawn and Turkey Run. It's fair to say Louisville has an abundance of parkland and recreational facilities. We thought this would be a good time to kind of step back and take a look at our parks and parks facilities and talk about the future. And here with us to do that are representatives from some of the entities that oversee, maintain, and preserve Louisville's parks. Bennett Knox is here. He's, among other things, administrator of Jefferson Memorial Forest and Natural Areas. Bennett, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
From Louisville Metro Parks. Also, Ben Johnson, Assistant Director of Recreation. Ben, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Layla George is here, familiar name at Louisville Public Media. She's now the president and CEO of the Olmsted Parks Conservancy, which works with the city to preserve Louisville's Olmsted Design Parks, of which there are more than you might think. We'll talk about that. Layla, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Last but not least, David Morgan, president of the Parklands of Floyd's Fork, the latest jewel in Louisville's collection of parks. It includes some 4,000 acres of parklands and amenities. Well, let's first of all get an overview of your various areas, starting with Metro Parks. Bennett, can you give us a sense of the total size of Metro Parks and Recreation?
120 parks. I have Layla give me the number on the parkways, but there's, I think, at least six parkways. 13,000 acres. That's within the Metro Park system, so that doesn't include the parklands. So I manage Jefferson Memorial Forest, so 6,800 acre park, and then we are the Natural Areas Division of Parks, so we actually maintain an additional 1,000 plus acres. So really, as far as the acreage of total parkland, we're responsible in Meyer for about half the acreage now. A lot of that is at the forest and is just growing naturally.
It is parks and recreation, and Ben, you're on the recreation side. Tell us a little bit about what you oversee.
Yeah, so I have direct oversight of the community centers that the city operates, approximately 16 different facilities. We run from Berrytown all the way out to Sun Valley, of course, California, Park Hill, Shelby Park, things of that nature that people are more familiar with. We also do adult programming as well. Some people don't realize that. We do adaptive and inclusive recreation. We do programming for adults. We do some silver sneakers for seniors. So we really are from A to Z, arts to Zumba.
Now, Metro Parks overlaps, of course, with other entities represented here, among them the Olmsted Conservancy. Layla George, tell us a little bit about how the Conservancy operates in conjunction with Metro Parks.
Sure. We have 17 Olmsted Parks and 6 parkways here in Louisville, and Olmsted Parks Conservancy serves as the private partner to Louisville Parks and Recreation when it comes to preserving, protecting, and enhancing those Olmsted design spaces. So we fill in and we help fundraise for capital investments, whether it's new walking paths or playgrounds. We also manage a lot of the natural areas within the Olmsted Park. So a lot of the trail work, a lot of the meadows and prairies and the woodlands in our Olmsted Parks are under our purview.
Now, for those who may not know, when we say Olmsted Parks, we mean parks designed by the firm of Frederick Law Olmsted, the legendary
yes,
designer.
Yes, so Frederick Law Olmsted is the father of landscape architecture here in this country, famously designed Central Park in New York City, and he designed the system as a whole. So he designed Shawnee, Cherokee, and Iroquois as the flagship parks, and then the parkways, and then his son, John Charles Olmsted, and the firm came and filled in with pocket parks within the urban core.
Now, the Conservancy is a relatively new organization, right?
Well, compared to some organizations, we are 30 years, so we had a big birthday year this year. So we've been around a little while, but certainly not as long as the parks.
All right. David Morgan, the parklands, sort of the new kid on the block as part of the parks.
We're definitely the infant.
Yeah.
Yes.
But what a newcomer it is. Tell us about the parklands and how this new piece of the park system came to be.
Well, basically, it's gone from an idea in the early 2000s to an organization being formed in 2004, 21st Century Parks. And in essence, the idea was to do what Olmsted did and do it again out in the rapidly growing area in eastern and southeastern Jefferson County along Floyd's Fork. So it's been amazing to see it go from an idea to a construction plan and a master plan design park system to the opening of 4 parks, which now we fully operate. You know, 2017 marked the first year of operating an almost 4,000 acre park system. And what's unique about us is not only were we involved with the design, but we're actually operating it. And we're also, I reference this as an infant, we're out actually needing to raise each year 100% of our budget. It's a private part, you know, private-public partnership. We have properties from Future Fund, as well as Metro Parks, and then also properties that 21st Century Parks acquired, and that land is preserved for parklands in perpetuity.
Now, is some of this land still being developed into parkland?
At this point in time, we have pretty well completed the master plan. We just opened up the brand new Woodland Garden in Broad Run Park, which I think for park lovers, if you haven't been to Broad Run, it's going to become one of the people's most favorite places to visit in the parklands. We also just finished up a brand new trailhead in the middle of the Strand, which is the connector between the North Parks and the South Parks. And the wonderful thing about that is it brings people right to the middle of one of the most beautiful sections of the parklands that previously you had to basically be able to walk 6 miles round trip or ride. And now this, you know, in keeping with our approach of the park is for everyone, people can bring loved ones out that may not have the mobility to go on a 6 mile walk and enjoy that area.
Every year we report on a survey from the Trust for Public Land, which ranks park systems throughout the country, the 100 largest cities. Louisville ranked 81st out of 100 this year, which is three spots higher than it was over last year. It seems like it's weighted down quite a bit by spending, which actually went up this year, but accessibility, which and they point out that only 38% of Louisville residents live within a 10-minute walk to the park. That's low compared to the national median, which is 69%. And I guess my question is, some of that is inherited, I assume, Bennett, but how do you respond to that? And how can you make parks more accessible to more people?
Well, I think clearly that survey, by the nature of us being a merged community, I think that's a valid point, that the methodology kind of shorts us a little bit. There were other aspects of that survey that we have to be honest about, like, for instance, per capita spending on mm-hmm. operating expenses, Louisville relative to the average for other parks agencies, I think 40%, quite low. So there's some other things that we get probably dinged on in terms of how we rank that we should really look at. Certainly we need to do a better job of being efficient with the resources that we are given. So those two things together kind of paint a picture of where we are relative. But in terms of connectivity, this community is really, as a parks employee, we're very proud of how much progress we've made over the years. You've got the parklands that's opened up, forest in Southwest Louisville's 4,800 acres. So yes, we probably need more parks in Southwest Louisville because, you know, distance-wise to the forest, even though the acreage is large, we have some communities that need to have access. But a lot of progress being made on those connecting pathways. The Louisville Loop certainly is just visionary in this community. And so we're all, you know, excited about where we're going, and I think you're going to see our score continue to improve, certainly as we all work together.
And you, David, the parklands is where it is. I mean, there's a finite amount of land available, but he brings up the Louisville Loop. Let's talk about that a little bit. That is a part of the connectivity.
Yeah, definitely. Our park system is encompassed in the Louisville Loop system, so our loop was designed such that it's part of the connectivity long-term with that, as Bennett said, a very visionary look at Louisville and being able to have a ring around the entirety of the city. Like Bennett, I think having these type of connections and the walking paths, that should hopefully ultimately help with the park score from the Trust for Public Land. We're excited that the score is improving. We as a master plan park system, you know, as an example, some of the criteria that's utilized, such as basketball hoops per capita, we made a conscious decision not to have basketball courts in the parklands because we felt like it was served well through other means within the community. So many churches have basketball courts. There are a lot of indoor facilities. Other parks have courts. But long term, I think the fact that we have such a great park system across the board for the entirety of Jefferson County, I think the connectivity and access within 10 minutes walk will ultimately continue to improve over the years, and our score will go up.
Ben, I'll turn to you because this is in your area. Talk about splash pads. That's kind of a newer concept, isn't it, as an alternative to pools?
Yeah, it is. And so I'm glad we got a positive score there. But and it's ironic that we got that at the same time we're struggling with, you know, with aquatics and the pools. So that does say that we're moving in the right direction. Not that anyone wanted to close the pools, but The Splash Pass as an amenity can appeal to more people, obviously a lot less expensive, and a lot more people to have something to do with sort of in a casual way. You're not committed to a swimming outing, but, you know, you're out. We talk about being walkable. So you're out, you're walking with your kids, your grandkids, or whomever. Mm-hmm. They can splash, you can walk, you can read, you know, things of that nature. So that's, you know, very important. And I'm glad to know that that shows that we're moving in the right direction in that area. Restrooms obviously are hugely important for obvious reasons. And I will put in this little plug. We have to take care of them. And I say we, I don't mean parks and recreation. I mean the community. They're tough to maintain as it is, and we accept that. And we have quite a few of them, and they're needed. But when we have to spend time, money, and resources replacing things that have been vandalized for absolutely no reason and been destroyed, and I'm talking about destroyed, not just painted on, which is bad enough in and of itself, and the only people that get punished are our park users. So we just want the community to understand, if you see something like that, report it. And if you happen to be one of those people, stop.
How big of a problem is that? I know some of the Olmsted parks are very popular, Layla, and the actions of a few really make it difficult for others. How big of a problem is it with the Olmsted parks?
It's a huge problem. Vandalism is a major problem in a lot of our parks. Ben was just talking maybe about Boone Square. We just invested, you know, $250,000 in a new bathroom facility there, and two sinks were damaged. We had windows broken. We had bricks thrown at new doors. That stuff all has to be replaced. And in the meantime, those bathrooms are taken offline during a time when kids are getting out of school and those parks are seeing more use.
I want to come back to you, Bennett, and talk about Jefferson Memorial Forest, which you oversee. For some folks, it seems like it's a well-kept secret in the southwestern part of the county.
Yeah, that's I've heard that phrase for quite a while. I think there's two sides that, yes, that's true. But on the other side, if you like to hike, if you like to camp, if you like to fish, a lot of folks know about the forest.
Sure.
We always need to do a better job marketing-wise. But, you know, we 6,800-acre forest. It's the largest park in Louisville, but it's actually the largest nature preserve in Louisville. That's really one of the primary purposes of the forest, in addition to being a woodland tribute to veterans, which is a historical reason the park was established. So miles of hiking trails, campground facility, you know, great amenities in terms of nature. We have a master plan that calls for a really significant investment to improve our facilities. That's a need for us. That's why we're excited about our friends group, Wilderness Louisville. A big thing that we've got going on right now is really we're as the Naturage Division of Parks. So outside of the things that Layla mentioned that they do specifically in the Olmsted Parks, we manage Naturage for Left Metro Parks. And we're really trying to develop synergy between our environmental education programs, which we offer for kids, 5,000 kids a year come through the forest, as well as our stewardship activities, and then just promoting outdoor recreation as a benefit to the community for health. So we have a large initiative called the West Louisville Outdoor Recreation Initiative that we're leading. I'd love to talk about that. It is really an effort for our department to create more equitable access to nature programming, the infrastructure that supports that kind of programming. It's part of the mayor's strategic plan. It's a really a key goal of the Office of Resilience in terms of what we're trying to do in the community to improve community health. And we're really focused on the need for that type of programming activities in support of broader community goals in terms of education attainment, health and wellness, as well as creating opportunities for youth to get into our field, which is really a key goal of what we're trying to do is diversify our workforce in terms of the folks that are represented doing this kind of programming.
John has been waiting. Hi, John. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a lifelong Louisville resident. I grew up adjacent to Cherokee Park in the 50s. And as a kid playing around Big Rock, I would see horseback riders come through on the bridle path. And it actually, I think, was probably the genesis of a lifelong love affair with horses that I have to this day at almost 70 years old. It's been probably 20 years or so ago that we hauled horses over to Rock Creek Riding Stable, and we rode the bridle path across the bridge on 64 all the way to the water trough at the Grinstead Drive or Lexington Road entrance of the park and back. And it was just a wonderful experience. You know, in that Louisville is home to the Kentucky Derby and is identified with horses, I'm curious what the status is of horseback riding in the park systems in general and in Cherokee Park in particular, if it's still allowed, and if it's not, how come?
Layla, I know you, well, you want to talk about Cherokee Park a little bit?
Sure. So right now you can ride horses in Iroquois Park. That's one of the Olmsted parks that does allow horseback riding. We received funding from the city about a year ago for a master plan of the trail system for Cherokee, Seneca, and Iroquois. And part of that master planning process involves us looking at the trails in those three parks to determine the best usage for them, whether it's pedestrian trails or mountain biking trails or equestrian trails. So we are looking at that right now to either add more trails, close certain trails, mitigate erosion issues, and things like that. So that's an ongoing process that we're involved with now. But I don't see horseback riding coming back to Cherokee to answer that question.
And, Benny, you can speak to it in terms of Jefferson Memorial Forest.
Sure. So there, you can go to our website, bestparksever.com, and check out what parks have different amenities. So I do believe Long Run Park may allow horseback riding out at the forest in particular. So that we have a master plan that does call for, because we're in a rural area, there are a lot of folks who still own horses out in southwest Louisville. And we heard through public meetings that they still wanted that amenity. So we have incorporated in horseback trails into our master plan. So two things specifically. We received a grant a few years ago from a recreational trails program, and we redid the trail system in the Paul Yost section to design it so that it's suitable for horses. And we've just, although it took away some of the up and down kind of aspects that some horse riders like, it is very sustainably built, and we've gotten great feedback on the trail system for the riders that really like a more leisurely type trail. Bigger than that is the Louisville Loop. It does call for soft surface trails, not just the paved loop trail system around the community, but in southwest Louisville particular, as part of our master plan, we're trying to connect the eastern part of the forest in Fairdale to the western part out by Valley Station. And there is calls for a soft surface trail to basically ultimately create a 50-mile opportunity for horses and also mountain bikers on that system. So that's in the plans. So at the moment, come out to the forest. We've got a 13-mile trail system for you to ride your horse in, just trailer in.
Joe has a question about Iroquois Park. Joe, what's on your mind?
Hey, we live nearby, and we love using the park facilities. And I'm curious why the road up to the top is closed so often. Yeah, it makes for a nice, quiet walk, but there are a lot of nice stuff up on top that we can't access about half the time.
That's closed on certain days, right,
sure.
Layla?
It is open on Wednesdays and weekends. One of the issues is the Parks Department doesn't have overnight staff, so closing the gate sometimes has been a problem. And when it's not closed, vandalism is a major issue up there, sort of as we've touched on in other public spaces. It is beautiful up there. We've invested a lot of money for the North Overlook at Iroquois Park, and it's gorgeous. And to your point, there are a lot of people who love quiet walks up to the top of the overlook. It's narrow. There's some blind curves, and there's a big drop off there that I'm sure you've noticed. So it's not the safest road condition, which is another reason we have limited the amount of time that we keep it open.
That was some of our May 31st discussion of Louisville's Parks on In Conversation. Our guests included Bennett Knox and Ben Johnson from Louisville Metro Parks and Recreation, Olmsted Conservancy President Layla George, and Parklands of Floyd's Fork President David Morgan. We'll be back with a live program next week. Thanks to all our guests and our In Conversation production team, Kaylin Jackson, Brad Yost, Ashley Clark Thompson, and Russell Wells. Our opening and closing theme was composed by Kojin Toshiro. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Coming up on WFPL's In Conversation, Louisville's free public library system. Our guests will include Library Director Lee Birchfield. We'll talk about library services, the system's new facilities, and how Louisville's libraries are affected by cuts in the new metro budget. Plus, we want to hear from you. Join us for a discussion of Louisville's libraries on In Conversation, Friday at 11 a.m. on 89.3 WFPL.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.